It's the Frank Five Fellows podcast series. Informal conversations with recent liberal arts grads. They're in business, they're engineers, they're educators, they're artists. What does the road to success look like when you're just out of college? In this episode, the fellows and their faculty partners talk about how their understandings and definitions of success have changed since they graduated. Up next, Marissa Davis and Rachel Burma.
How do you think about what it means to live a good life, a life that you're happy with? And I'm particularly curious about how and if you thought about that before college, how you were thinking about that in college, and how your ideas about what it means to live a good life or a successful life have changed since college. I know Absolutely. That's a big question.
It is indeed a big question, but fortunately or unfortunately, it's one that I've thought a lot about. And in fact, is one that my understanding of success, my definition of success has really evolved over time. Growing up, you know, I'm one of three girls, and my mother for most of my life was a single parent. And so for me at that time, I think growing up, the idea of success was to largely economically, socially be in a better position than my mother, my grandmother, you know, a lot of my family members, because the idea was that their sacrifices paved the way so that I could actually have a better life. And so when I think at that point, even before college, when I thought about what success looked like, it was being able to have a great job that paid well, to receive all the accolades and accomplishments that would come from doing well, either in school or in whatever job I would take on. And then when I got to college, it at least the first half of it was a similar kind of thinking. Okay, my goal here is to do well academically so that I can then get the right kind of job that I would need outside of college, or to get the right grades that I needed to ultimately be a strong candidate for graduate school, so that at least at that time I could go to a good law school, become a great lawyer, and be well regarded for the work that I was doing. And at that point, it was public interest law that I was interested in. And then several years after college, you know, it was a constant journey of thinking that in order to be successful, it rested a lot with all the things that I could do. And then there was a point where I realized that just doing things was never sufficient to actually find proper full meaning in life. And that in fact, for me, the way I see what success looks like now isn't really all the things that I can do, but rather it's really understanding fundamentally who I am and accepting the fullness of who I am and offering the best of those pieces of me to things that I do, so that it isn't that I'm starting from a place of just trying to do certain things well, but it's that because I am feeling good about myself and that I understand and acknowledge the wholeness of who I am, I have no other option but to let some of that out. And some of the things that I end up getting to do is just like an extension of me wanting to express the fullness of who I am. And that is at least how I see success now. And I think when I'm when there is, I wouldn't say necessarily happiness, because I think happiness is kind of a fleeting thing. It's more finding peace with who I am. It paves the way for a lot of other opportunities.
Up next, Kara Peterman and Elizabeth Stevens.
I don't know why anyone expects a college freshman at 17, 18, 19 years old to have any idea what they want to do with their lives. But I truly felt like Swarthmore enabled us to become better people, to make mistakes, to change our minds, to explore, to be young people in a nurturing environment. And it's that part that, you know, the life after Swarthmore, you don't get too many of those communities.
It's so interesting, because we do think about like messing up and succeeding as kind of different things, mm-hmm. you know, categorically different things. But I think here messing up can be part of succeeding, which is an excellent segue into this impossible question, which is so. What does success mean to you? But that's such a big question. So I guess what I would ask, to just put a spin on it, is has your definition of success changed? Like when you were here in college, did you have an idea of what it would mean to be successful in life? And has that shifted at all as you've been out of college and in the world?
I believe, and I believe I've always believed this, that a successful person is a happy person. Somebody who is content in their life, somebody who is satisfied with their existence. You know, it's an existential satisfaction, and to me that is success. Whatever situation brought you to that existential satisfaction, to me has worked out well for you. In college, I can say that, just as an anecdotal story here, as an anecdote, I did very badly in one of my math classes in my first year of Swarthmore, and things started going downhill right at the beginning of the semester. And because I was failing so badly, I sort of thought it was a lost cause, and gave up as a consequence. And it's very easy to give up when you're doing badly. And the whole semester, it was just a constant deflation, where I would put in the effort, or put in some effort, let's be honest, not all the effort. I would put in some effort and get a very low grade, and I finished with a D in the class, and it's on my transcript for all the world to see. That was a D in linear algebra, not even a very advanced math class. And I, at the time, that was a very obvious failure. But in hindsight, it wasn't a failure because I got a D in the class. It was a failure because I gave up. And so when I think about what success means now, you know, I consider something successful when I come away better because of it, you know. So a lecture or a class, and even in grad school, if I came away with more knowledge, if my knowledge was improved, if I came away a better person, if I came away with a wider worldview, then I considered it a success. The grade, you know, is much more arbitrary for me after that point. And even now, you know, I mean, real life doesn't give you too many grades, but you know, what other people think of how much you learned is inconsequential to what you actually learned. And it's the same with the basic definition of happiness. If you are not making very much money, or if you are living you know, in a not very nice apartment or something, but you're happy about it, then it doesn't matter what the person next door thinks. It doesn't matter at all. If you're content with how you're contributing to the world and how you're living your life, then that's the ultimate definition of success, I think.
Up next, Kimberly St. Julian Varnon and Saeed Atchan.
Kimberly, what does success mean to you?
Do you want pre-Swarthmore me or current me?
Well, we can juxtapose them.
Before Swarthmore, success was making at least six figures and having a Mercedes. That was the end all be all for me, because I had watched all these lawyer movies and they all make tons of money and drive really expensive cars. So like doing that and being able to like make enough money so my parents could retire, those were my ideas for success. Now it's less like money plays very little in my idea of success. Now it's mostly about helping my community and having a legacy, but it doesn't necessarily have to be personally attached to me, but something I've done or something I've started has helped so many others that it continues to affect change generationally. That's the big thing that I'm looking at now. And so, yeah, I think success and our idea of success changes as we get older and get exposed to more things. So when I'm 80, I might have a totally different idea, but right now that's what it is.
And so how will you know that you have been successful in life as well as in work?
I don't know. I think it's really interesting because like an example is that I've come full circle. My department head now at the high school was my AP economics and AP government teacher in high school. Oh, wow. And I remember just battering him with questions like, what should I major in? And then when I went to Swarthmore, I'm like, what classes should I take? And then as I was graduating from Swarthmore, which graduate program should I go to? And now I'm getting emails from my students who are in college now who are asking me, should I go to law school? What classes should I take? And so I think that's kind of success, where I made enough of an impact in them that they seek my help and they trust me. It's a lot of responsibility. And I told my department, I'm like, thank you so much. I did not realize how much stress I put on you with these questions. But I think that's success, and having my students achieve the lives that they want to live, I think, is a big part of my idea of success.
Up next, Nell Bong-Jansen and Tim Burke.
Do you have other sort of fancies that you permit yourself occasionally, or other people in theater or in performance or in writing, where you look at them and you say, that's what I want to be?
Yeah. I think I ideally would really love to be the artistic director of a theater that prioritizes the values in art making I believe in. And for me, that is a balance of having an experimental sort of pig iron aesthetic, but making work that is not insular. And that's working with people who are actually in that community and do not identify as artists. I mean, I think one of my goals is sort of like Oscar Eustace's The Public, which is in some ways trying to break down the binary we've created in this country of who's an artist and who's not. But really actually using theater as a way of creating stronger bonds between the people who make up a city or a place.
So your vision of success and of art is sort of so relentlessly outward driven. You're really thinking carefully about how to connect with audiences and communities, how to do service and work to them. Is there a part of when you think about your aspirations that you sort of that's for you? I mean, that's kind of in a sense selfish, that you would say, okay, this is for me. This is what rewards me, and I'm I gotta have that.
I think I wouldn't really be happy doing one or the other in terms of the balance of making art and also thinking big picture about what it is that I'm doing. So I've been in both of those situations where I've been in a rehearsal room and going gig to gig and making the piece. And I love that, but there's a point where I want to be working towards something larger. I don't want to go gig to gig. I want to be part of an organization that I believe in. And that, you know, will give me a certain kind of autonomy. And then I've also done the opposite where I've been more of an administrator for a larger, you know, regional theater. And I really missed the art making part. It was great talking about mission and what our theater is trying to do, but I missed the sense of, you know, little community that you form when you're making a piece together and getting to share it with the world. So I think that would be hard for me to have to choose one or the other. And I think the kind of dreamy thing about being an artistic director, along with the many other less dreamy things about it, but the dreamy thing is that you do get a balance of, you know, creating these tiny communities in a rehearsal room that leads to an encounter, and then also being able to think big picture about, okay, what are we doing here and who are we doing it for? And I think, you know, sort of my path in theater so far has been craving more and more authorship over what I'm doing. I started out as a performer, then learned that, oh, I could be a performer in devised work where I'm actually helping to write and shape the piece. Then I started doing dramaturgy, which is really looking at the research and structure of a play. And then from that, I craved more authorship and started craving directing. So it's sort of gone further and further into a place of, yeah, having a greater sense of authorship over what I'm doing.
I mean, these seem to be some of the central, I mean, we're talking about meta skills when people talk about the gig economy and, you know, the kinds of economic lives that recent graduates are living. This is sort of that skill that seems important, is to not plan too far ahead and to be willing to jump at things as they present themselves. Is there a jump you have already vowed to yourself you would never take? Like, would you write television if television is where it's at? Are there artistic jumps you won't take? Are there career jumps you're sure you won't do? Are there places you're certain you would never live?
That's such a good question. I think about that a lot. I am not ruling out TV. There's a lot I'm not ruling out yet, even if it would be selling out, more because I'm curious. There's a lot I would be open to. I'm curious what that's like. The things I wouldn't do are more things that I have experienced and know I don't want to. So I know, for example, it's really frustrating for me to be in a purely administrative position at a big place, because then I'm like, well, why am I in theater? I could be using these skills somewhere else and making more money. And so I have also just realized, and this is part of the professional development I've been doing on this artistic leadership grant I'm on now. We talk a lot about values clarification, which has been immensely helpful to me. I feel like it was a very hot in the 80s kind of thing, but I love it. I'm a big believer in values clarification. And it's just become increasingly clear to me that I want to either be heading an organization where I can shape it around my own values, or be working in the service of someone whose values are aligned with mine. Because it's really frustrating not to be, and I've been in that position before. So really being able to articulate what my values are and what kind of theater I want to be at has been really helpful for me saying then, actually that theater doesn't seem like a good fit, or working with that leader doesn't seem like a good fit. And being able to say no to that with the confidence that I'm doing it for the right reasons has been really helpful.
Up next, Sam Sussman and Krista Thomason.
What advice do you have that I can pass on to my first year advisees? And they're coming and sitting and talking to me about what classes they should take or anything else. What do you wish you could go back and tell either the first years or yourself?
My brother just started at Wesleyan. Look, I think you should really follow, this is cliche, until you do it, you should follow your passions. Right? That's one of those things in life that's just, it's a cliche until you actually do it, and then it's real. You're under so much pressure. You know, one of the real downsides of elite education is that you're made to feel that because you can, in theory, do everything, you know, you kind of have this pressure to do everything. And if not, you're wasting this valuable time at this remarkable place. And Swarthmore is a remarkable place. But it's also a place that's open to whatever form of yourself you want to be. And I think you shouldn't feel pressure to find that form right away. You should take your time. You should take very different classes. You should hang out with very different people. You should try to be embedded in a few different social groups. You should definitely seek out friends who are different than you. I'm not talking about, you know, the superficial categories that we all know. They're from a different place, you know, they have a different class background. Not that these are superficial things, but what I mean is people who really see the world in different ways. Right? People whose metaphors are different than yours. That's what you should try to find. And I think, you know, you should trust yourself. Right? If you think you really want to take that, you know, fourth class in English literature, which maybe commits you to doing it as a major or minor, well, yeah, maybe that means you want to do a major or minor. That's okay, right? And I think it's important to just have a little patience with, you know, hey, like, maybe don't stress that much about your first job. Your first job might not be the thing that, you know, brings you, it might not be the truest, last, best form of you. It would be weird if it was. You know, just take some time to experiment with different versions of yourself until you find something that makes you comfortable. You don't have to, you don't have to do that econ major.
I like that you said, follow your passion sounds easy until you do it. And the equivalent that I find myself saying a lot is learn how to trust your gut, which is harder than it sounds, much harder than it sounds. It's a lot easier, I think, particularly as you were describing Swarthmore being a very cerebral sort of place. It's very easy to second guess yourself. And it's very easy to listen to that smart sounding advice. And it's harder to stick with that hunch, that gut feeling, that sense that you have that's not maybe articulate, that's maybe implicit, that isn't something that you can fully put words on, and yet that might be leading you in the right direction more than you think.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by the Adelot Foundation and the Language and Media Centers at Swarthmore College. To learn more, visit www.swarthmore.edu/Adelot-Foundation. That's Swarthmore, Swarthmore, Adelot, Aydelotte Foundation.